Hello and welcome to another Straight Bullets. In this episode I'm going to be talking about the use of batting rounds by the Royal Ulster Constabulary. It's paramount at this stage for me to qualify a few things. Firstly, it's not my intention to change any minds in relation to the use of batting rounds. The federal riot gun, as it's known, had the potential to kill or severely injure, inflicted hurt both physical and mental on our community. Its use primarily in the 70s and 80s was responsible for the deaths of 17 people, 8 of whom were children. All of those people were Catholics. The batting round is a term that includes rubber bullets, which was used primarily in the 70s, and of course plastic bullets. So I'm just going to couch this episode in terms of my experience as a batting gunner. I also must qualify once again that my words are not representative of any other members of the Royal Ulster Constabulary. I do feel it's important for me to mention that because from time to time I do get a bit of grief from ex-colleagues, especially those in senior ranks. So I just wanted to add that. Well, if I'm honest, it was incredibly difficult finding a way to approach the subject of batting rounds in the context of the Northern Ireland Troubles. I guess it's easy to get funneled down one of two roads. Either they were a deadly weapon deployed by the security forces in a naked attempt to oppress, injure or kill innocent people, or that they were a necessary and, on the whole, non-lethal deterrent to protect lives and property from destruction or damage by petrol bombs, nail bombs, blast bombs, pipe bombs, large pieces of masonry or gunfire, to keep violent rioters of opposing factions apart, and even as a visual deterrent when deployed but not used. Even so, those who have known grief or injury would understandably agree with the former, while those who have been on the sharp end during a riot and been hit by bombs, bullets or masonry would agree with the latter. Indeed, for even suggesting the former, I've been lambasted and vilified by several RUC colleagues. But as a few ex-military friends said to me, and I found their analysis very apt and on the mark, such RUC colleagues never wanted the Troubles to end or wanted them to end on their own terms. And so they fill their days on social media lashing out at anyone with an alternative view. And so, once again, without wanting to repeat myself, but I find that I must qualify this podcast as presenting my views only. So, instead of taking either of these two roads, I'm just going to talk about my experiences as a batting gunner. Okay, so the federal riot gun, and it was known just in the job as the FRG, was the first weapon of this type I was trained in. This would have been around 1989-1990. However, it certainly wasn't a case of being handed the weapon and firing a few rounds down the range before heading out onto the street with it. Invariably, the training, as with all weapons, was rigorous and included weapon familiarisation as well as stance, plus how the batting gunner is supported by a spotter and a shieldman. Naturally, the range was outdoor. In those days, riot gear usually comprised of an ill-fitting helmet with no comms, your flak jacket, a shirt if it was summer, or a NATO pullover if it was winter. A Dartex jacket might have been worn if it was raining. Of course, I'm talking about rainwater, but it could also mean raining petrol bombs or blast bombs, masonry, or anything that could be picked up and thrown at you with the intention of inflicting injury. The NATO and the Dartex could also be worn during the hours of darkness. Riding with a shirt was really for summer's day riots. Anything in between, well, you just mix it up as best you can. Also, just the standard issue trousers, or maybe patrol trousers if you had them, and whatever boots or shoes you bought yourself. Steel toe capped, always preferable, was a good idea to prevent a smashed foot. Oh yes, and maybe a pair of patrol gloves Are those gloves the army had with protective padding for your knuckles? If you could maybe swap them for a few hot cans, or maybe just give the soldier a couple of quid for them, just whatever works really. The gear was then completed by the addition of a rat batten of wood and longer than your basic batten. And that was it. No fireproof suits, no armadillo padding or fireproof balaclavas. Inevitably, being in the shield line and facing off any intense ratting commonly resulted in various injuries, from burns to broken bones. Plus your shield might have cracked or split in half, been warped by fire, and you may have had your baton wrenched from you as you worried about the vulnerability of your Ruger. Although there were a few times when things were becoming hot and heavy across the line, when we removed some Rugers from our holsters for safekeeping nearby, as things began to deteriorate quickly and very violently. I have to say also that little green bungee cords, known as twists, were also very popular. What you did, you fixed these around the bottom of your trousers at the top of your boots so you could look like a wannabe paratrooper. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So back to the training. And firstly, you'd be taken through familiarisation, which is self-explanatory. Basically how to break open, load, unload the gun, deal with a misfire, and practice in terms of firing stance, position, and really just sizing up the gun and its weight as well as its sights and trigger. The range itself was very dystopian in form, usually an old hangar or an old storage facility. The targets were large rectangles of rubber sheeting. They were black and about 6 feet in length by 2 or 3 in width. They looked like the strange skins of some animal drying, and they were about a foot off the ground. A crude horizontal line would have been drawn at a level representing waist height of an average adult, and this of course would have been drawn previously by an instructor. This was the line we were to aim below. The actual round was manufactured to deliver the equivalent of a baton strike, but given the nature of the round's physical form and its subsequent trajectory, this could be problematic, and hence training in its use was crucial and rigorously supervised. If you couldn't adapt your aim to the round's trajectory, then it was simple, you didn't classify in that weapon and would not be authorised to carry it. You see, the round has a concave trajectory in that when it's fired, its flight path dips before gradually rising and striking the target. If your aim's too low, you risk hitting the ground midway and spinning off in a different direction. Too high, and there's a real risk that when the round rises, it may strike the target above waist height, which includes the head or face, of course, and whereby death or serious injury could be the outcome. So there's a lot of pressure on a baton gunner. You want to protect your colleagues from bombs and heavy masonry, but equally, you don't want to kill or seriously injure your target, let alone anyone else in close proximity to them or an innocent bystander. The round itself is so sluggish that you can practically watch its path as it leaves the muzzle and heads towards a target. And yes, in an actual riot, especially one in daylight, your target can sometimes also see the round's approach. The muzzle flash from the FRG is a good indicator, more so during the hours of darkness, that a round is on its way. During range practice, the round would strike the rubber sheets with a distinctive slap. Subsequent training would see the addition of Land Rovers parked side on to the targets, where you would be in the rear beside another gunner and using the Land Rover's narrow gun ports to both aim and fire through. There's no need me telling you how important it was to ensure you stuck the muzzle out of the port rather than just behind it, because you didn't want to discharge around inside the back of a truck and have it bouncing around at speed with you and your colleagues in its general flight path. And just while you're trying to be mindful of where your muzzle is, the ongoing riot outside your vehicle, trying to identify targets, plus remember the descriptions for any subsequent evidential processes, all the while also trying to concentrate on your field of fire, just as the vehicle you're in starts filling up with a fog of cordite smoke from the gun. Now, it's a given that you and your crew would have to be in fairly dire straits if there's two of you firing baton rounds in rapid succession from the inside of a Land Rover, but this was a classification shoot, so the instructors crank things up a bit to see if you were still capable of safely delivering an aim shot under pressure. Oh, and just for added measure, at least one instructor would be practically perched on your shoulder while wearing a gas mask to protect themselves from the thick soup of cordite smoke filling the truck. The combination of all those elements, the instructor's keen unblinking eyes fixed on you and framed by the eyelets of the gas mask, all seeming to float at your side amongst the smoke, your focus on the sight, elevation, the target, martial percussion of rounds being fired by your colleagues. It was intense, but then I guess so was a rat and full pelt. So that was a classification shoot, and certainly not all who attended passed. Once you classified to carry the FRG, though, you also had to carry the rounds, which came in a metal ammunition box that you lugged around from the armory into the truck, together with your long arm and any additional magazines. On an aside, I remember you had to be diligent when you did an armory itinerary, because especially in the case of the batten round boxes, as some individuals in some sections in some stations, not many, very infrequently, would discharge a round or two for whatever reason, but not when a riot was on or any kind of public order disturbance. I'd conclude, but they didn't record that discharge anywhere. And when they returned the ammo box with the strip that held the missing batten rounds, that was shoved at the bottom of the box. Or was it six? Anyway, all this connivory just meant that you had to empty each and every ammo box to make sure all the rounds were present and accounted for, and or corresponded to daily checks done by the station duty officers, and entries by section members in the armory book also had to coincide with the physical rounds present in the armory. So once you and your federal rat gun and your long arm and respective ammo were ensconced in the truck, it was just more kit for, if not directly responding to a riot in progress, you would be carrying the FRG due to the prevalence of riots in the area, which could suddenly erupt any time during your shift. Once you were on the line as a batten gunner by your side, you'd be conversing with one another when you could snatch a bit of breath. Both yourself and your spotter would be trying to identify individuals actively involved in riotin and who are in possession of any type of bomb, commonly petrol bombs, of course, but nail bombs, pipe bombs and blast bombs cannot be discounted. In addition to this, you would also have to be mindful of rioters who would threaten to endanger the life of any colleague by bringing down heavy masonry upon them, or if they were in possession of some form of weapon and using or about to use it in such a manner that the life of a colleague is in a serious risk. Of course, as well as that, you'd also be mindful of range and justification at all times. Your spotter would be noting descriptions of any persons hit by a batten round for subsequent arrest. Well, that's all fine and well me regurgitating the training manual and associated nuances with it. And of course, these days, I'm sure you could find all the documents relating to the discharge of batten rounds on the internet. But what was it like to fire the FRG in the context of your mind processing the fact that you were intrinsically aiming a firearm at another human being with the intention of discharging a batten round at that person? Well, as you can imagine, or try to imagine, your heart rate would be up anyway as you were facing off a violent riot. Well, you might be working out the possible trajectory of the round before firing, maybe even unaware that your peripheral vision had narrowed down into a tunnel filled only by your gun sight on your target. Even the clamour of the riot would begin to fade as you squeezed the trigger, mouth dry, breathing slowed, relying on your sheet man to protect you from any incoming, as once some of the rioters may have spotted you, you could be assured that they would try and bring whatever they could down upon your head. You waited for a fleeting moment of stillness within you as you fired a round and observed it strike the rioter on the thigh, or sometimes watch as a round quickly loses energy and drops harmlessly at the feet of the rioters, only to be picked up and flung back at you. As well as that, you'd also find that a number of rioters would hold up things made of wood or corrugated iron as shields, or even wore several layers of clothes, or even stuff a scarf down each trouser leg, so anything to protect themselves if they should be struck by a batting round. I'm sure you've seen the photos of riders skulking behind makeshift barricades. If not, have a look on the internet. There's a number of such images from the likes of Drumcree, or even more recent Rad in Belfast and Derry. In fact, just talking about it, I remember one night, it must have been just after the Good Friday Agreement was signed, but it was a time of all the cavalcades through parts of the city. There was also a number of attacks, ironically, on police stations, because now that there was peace, as it were, there was calls for, of course, the RUC to be disbanded and all police stations to be immediately taken down. And I do remember on one occasion protecting a station using the button gun, and there was one character below us, and he was pushing his mate, and his mate was in a wheelchair, but he got his mate to hold a segment of wooden hoarding or a large piece of wood. So he was basically had this mobile barricade, so his mate was in the wheelchair. Whether he needed to be in the wheelchair or it was a stolen wheelchair or whatever, I've no idea, and we never found out. But anyway, his mate was in the wheelchair holding the piece of wood to protect them both from the batting rounds, while there was another wee crowd following this guy in the wheelchair, and they would now and again peek round the side of the board and fire petrol bombs or bricks towards us. So in essence, they had this kind of mobile barricade that was moving about, and I guess on recollection it was just bizarre and it was crazy, but it's just what it was, and it just summed up, I think, the whole evening for me. Anyway, while there's considerable pressure and responsibility around the carriage and the use of the batting gun, in light of the fact it can be a lethal weapon, and no matter what anybody says, batting gunners are always mindful of the tragic deaths and life-changing injuries caused by batting rounds during the early phases of troubles. Now, improved weapon development, deployment, technology and training has combined greatly to the potential lethalness of the batting gun being vastly reduced. Almost to zero, in fact, some people would say that it renders the whole weapon pointless. But as I said earlier, it's never my intention, especially in these podcasts, to change anybody's minds. And in this case, I'm not going to change anybody's mind, nor do I wish to change anybody's mind in respect of the batting gun or federal rad gun. And that was never my intention. These podcasts, really, they're just therapeutic processes of understanding for me, but which I find I'm better able to recount in whatever form, like maybe pseudo narratives of the past, of my own actual experiences, or a more research-based form constructed around my own experiences. Nevertheless, I'm really very grateful for each and every person who listens, no matter if you come away thinking it's a worthwhile listen or a waste of time. Naturally, I hope it's the former. Anyway, to close this podcast, I have two accounts from my own personal experience of use of the batting gun. I'll see if I can get the first one, and I'm not sure if I'm going to have time for the second one, because obviously I don't want to prattle on too long. So this was the first instance I want to talk about. It was during one of the Drumcree standoffs around about 1996. Unsurprisingly, Radin had broken out throughout the province in sporadic pockets of violence. It was a long, long week in our Land Rovers. This one morning, it was late, approximately 5:30 hours. We were stationary at a crossroads, site at an urban location. A rat had been going on in the area since early evening, but gradually increased in intensity towards midnight and through to about 0300 the following morning. While the vast bulk of ratters had retired after a busy few hours of wanton destruction of their own area and their intent to cause as much damage as they could to police, soldiers, property, and maybe a few unfortunate passers-by, and even on occasion each other, when the alcohol, sometimes drugs or whatever else, was mixing with her adrenaline, and confused rage got the better of them. The violence had considerably ebbed by 05:30, but pockets of die-hard rioters still prowled street corners and the glassy ruin of roads. At this point, one of these roving groups had already hit our vehicle with about 3 to 4 petrol bombs. This was a common tactic of rioters, to hit a truck with multiple bottles or sometimes sweetie jars filled with petrol before chucking a lit petrol bomb at the truck in the hope that it would be instantly engulfed in fire. And trying to drive a Land Rover when it's engulfed in fire can be quite a challenging experience. So on this occasion, I was button gunner and sat in the rear of the vehicle. And it wasn't long before both myself and the observer soon glimpsed the pale gold shiver of a flame appear from behind a section of barricade. Soon the figure of a petrol bomber emerged, and in his right hand he gripped a bottle capped by the flame. Even though the petrol bomber had a scar from time, it was obvious to me that he was quite young, probably around 14, 15 years old, and here he was out in the early hours of the morning, indulging in the dangerous activity of recreational riding. Now, no doubt others had dared him to throw the petrol bomb at us. When we began being hit by the unlit petrol bombs, I loaded my FRG and pushed its muzzle out of the gun port in an effort to gain an early sight picture of any other petrol bombers. And here, now, one was steadily approaching, a kid still. I could tell from his gait that he was mentally forcing himself towards us, probably thinking of the fire in his hand. Staring at a Land Rover, its dull grey skin scarred by a rain of bricks and fire the night before. He must have saw how the petrol he and his mates had doused our Land Rover in gleamed as it caught the light of the milky sun rising over another day of destruction. The kid's mind fixed on throwing the petrol bomb at us, and momentarily gazing in awe as our vehicle bloomed brighter than the sun. How his mates would cheer him, and how he would run back to them, for a moment standing taller than they were, having proved himself in some incendiary rite of passage. Something he'd laugh about, recounting later life, as long as the arc of his petrol bomb didn't lay out the path of a career in crime, and years wasted lying in prison, of course. And there was I, telling myself that I wasn't going to shoot a child, as my colleagues yelled for me to fire before he could throw the petrol bomb. Oh, one minor point. You're probably thinking, why did we not drive off? Well, the fact was our vehicle had calved. That is, the clutch had burnt itself out. And we were sat awaiting either a front lift or another crew to arrive with a strong enough length of rope to pull us away, maybe even to give us a shunt. But at that moment, we were caught in the space between breaking down and being recovered. And there I was, looking at this kid nervously approaching. I even remember rattling the gun off the sides of the port in some kind of feeble, pathetic effort in the hope that it would spook him, but I didn't imagine he heard. Nevertheless, I had to think fast because he was getting close to the minimum range in which I could fire, and so I stopped rattling the muzzle. I held the gun still, pushing it forward slightly, thinking if he manages to throw the petrol bomb, then when it strikes the side of the truck, some of the fire and petrol is going to come through the open port and all around me. So I stopped breathing, checked my aim, and squeezed the trigger. There was the click of the hammer, but that was all. No roar of a round discharging, no curtain of smoke, but odder still, there was no sound of glass crashing against the truck or warmth of fire and its sudden heat. Nothing. At some point, because when I looked through the sights, the kid was gone. He must have got spooked after all and ran off. My observer had lost sight of him as he'd been approaching due to an obstacle in his field of view. But there was no doubt the kid was gone. Plus the round had misfired anyway. But I've never been able to shake the feeling of nausea I'd had at the time, at the prospect of maybe hitting a child with a batten round. The fact that he'd been carrying a petrol bomb in itself a deadly weapon, to throw at us, at me, he was still a kid. It did have an effect on me. Does still have an effect on me, I'll not lie. When you think of what might have been, too dreadful to contemplate, and for what, a bit of crack or a moment of hate on his part, and me trying to protect myself and my colleagues. How as a society had we allowed coloured rags, ideologies, ignorance, the death of empire and religion to stain us in so much hatred? But that kid had disappeared, and I was glad. Glad too that the FRG had misfired. Maybe that was how it was meant to be. I don't know. I don't believe in fate or gods or religion, but still, that occurrence and those feelings have stayed with me ever since that day. Okay, well, I'm not going to have time for the next occurrence. It was kind of more on a light-hearted note, but again, it was an actual occurrence involving an FRG. But as I say, that kind of incident that I just recounted has kind of stayed with me, and kind of brought back a lot of feelings and a lot of thoughts and stuff. So what I'm going to do, I'm just going to close the episode, and if I get a chance, maybe in the next episode, I'll maybe try and get that other incident in. Although the next episode, I'm not too sure what to do with it. I might try something more contemporary, maybe even a kind of discussion of where we are, where we're going, with policing at the moment in the context of Northern Ireland. I'm thinking of the Police Service of Northern Ireland. It just seems to have been through one mess and one catastrophe after another this year. So anyway, just in closing, once again, thanks very much for listening to me. Thanks very much for downloading. Again, thanks for all the feedback. It's really positive, and it helps me, and I hope you too maybe get something out of these podcasts. I know they're a wee bit sort of haphazard maybe, and not as polished as I'd like them to be, but hopefully I can sort of maybe develop them a bit more as time progresses. Okay, so I'm just going to close now, and once again, thank you very much for tuning in. It's greatly appreciated. Thank you.